From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we're joined by John Podesta. Here's why. Over the last three decades, he's been one of the most influential figures in the United States and in progressive politics. He was White House Chief of Staff for President Clinton. He founded the think tank Center for American Progress, and he served as counselor to President Obama on energy and environmental issues. For our purposes on Transition Lab, John, perhaps along with Andy Card and Vice President Cheney, are the three most influential officials in modern history on transitions. By my count, John has been involved at a senior level in four presidential transitions: the Clinton transitions in and out of office, the Obama transition, which he chaired, and the Hillary Clinton transition preparations, where he oversaw the pre-election transition work. This episode will be released one day before Election Day, and we wanted John to be our final guest pre-election on Transition Lab because of his immense experience on transitions and his contributions as a great civil servant and public servant. So, John, thanks for being here.
Nice to be with you, David.
So let me start with this. I think people are very familiar with your career and your accomplishments, but what actually was it that attracted you to public service, and what was your first job with the government?
Well, I really got involved with public service through working in presidential campaigns. And I'm a very old person, so I started in 1968 in the presidential campaign of Eugene McCarthy. And I always thought that, you know, elections made a difference, that you could change things in America if you got engaged with the electoral process. I never was interested in it professionally, you know, to kind of become a professional campaign consultant. But when the fire bell rang, I always kind of ran to the fire, as it were. So I started that when I was still in college, in as I said, in 1968. My first job in government, though, was after the 1972 campaign. I was headed to law school at Georgetown, and I worked for the National Park Service, building an historic park in Northern Virginia, which is now called the Claude Moore Farm, was then called the Turkey Run Living History Farm. And so I was a wage grade employee for the National Park Service, digging fence post holes.
Incredible. I think something else that people don't probably know about you is you were at one point staff director for the Agricultural Committee too. Is that right?
Yeah, proving like lawyers can do anything. I grew up definitely in blue collar Chicago, and probably had, became a, I probably by that point I had actually been on a farm, but my life as a young and growing up was definitely hanging out on street corners on the northwest side of Chicago, not in agricultural America.
Well, I mean, hopefully people didn't say that agriculture to you was going to Whole Foods, but anyway. So, all right. So we're
my mother still maintained, even in the 1950s, my mother still maintained the Victory Garden that she started, you know, during World War II. So I guess there was something to that.
All right. So we're a day away from the election, and we're a nonpartisan organization. We've had Democrats, Republicans, career officials on this podcast. So you've had some great election days and you've had some terrible ones. How do you feel about tomorrow? What's going to happen?
Well, I think the race is pretty stable, and Biden is in a very good position. I think there are a lot of reasons for that. Probably number one is the president's handling of the coronavirus outbreak, but it is stable. He's ahead. He's over 50 in the key battleground states that slipped out of our reach in 2016 when Hillary won the popular vote by 3 million votes, but we lost the Electoral College. So if you look at Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, on average, Biden's been up by about anywhere from 5 to 8 points. So, it looks good, but you never know till the votes are in and the votes are counted. And in this year, that might take a little bit longer.
So let's go to the issue of presidential transitions. So you were nice enough to participate in a conference we had earlier this year. It's the conference we have every 4 years with whomever the candidates are. So this year it was with Biden team. On the last cycle, we did with five candidates, Clinton, Sanders, Cruz, and Trump. So one of the things you mentioned at that conference was that a transition is influenced by the personality of the principals. So you were involved in the Clinton, Obama, and Hillary Clinton transition efforts. And how were those different based on the personality of the principals?
Everybody's a bit different. They receive information differently. They prioritize going into government in somewhat different ways. I would say that in all the cases of that I was involved with, I worked for people who were very much into the policy process itself and into making good decisions about policy. They were deep on it. They cared about it. They wanted to make those critical decisions. But again, they kind of went at it a little bit differently, and all with some rigor, but with you know, kind of different spins. The one thing that I would say was quite different, and a lesson that I learned from the Clinton transition that I think was really helpful in the Obama transition, was that Clinton prioritized spending all those early days on selecting his cabinet, spent an enormous amount of time on it. I think he made very good choices, but he did that to the exclusion of picking his White House staff, which he did really right at the end. With the exception of a few people like Mac McClarty, he didn't get around to putting people in his White House staff positions. Well, why was that? I've always asked myself. And I think to some extent it was because when you're a governor of a state, your cabinet essentially is your staff. They're the people you're interacting with, you know, on a daily basis. When you're president, the team that you're working most significantly with, the team that plans your communication strategy, your legislative strategy, your national strategy, is your White House staff. It's a little bit different in the national security world, but it's primarily those are the people you spend your day with. Those are the people who help you either be successful or get you into jams. And I think the president was thinking that he was going to spend most of his time with those cabinet picks that he made. Turned out that it was a very long-serving cabinet. It was a great cabinet. But I think that he tripped up in not spending more time on his White House staff early. I raised that with then-Senator Obama the first time I saw him. We discussed this, and we corrected that and really built the White House staff first, which helped him then fill out his cabinet. Obviously, he had some ideas about who he wanted in the cabinet, but I think that was a better way to run the transition.
And what about the Hillary Clinton transition preparation? Obviously, you didn't win. We had Mike Levitt on this podcast, and he didn't win with Romney, but he made significant contributions to the art of transition planning. So how was the Secretary Hillary Clinton transition planning effort?
Yeah, I think we ran an even more full-blown, I suppose, pre-election transition. Over the years, it's become more acceptable to be serious about working on the transition before the election. Obviously, Vice President Biden has and Senator Harris have a full-blown staff already up and running working on a transition. We have multiple crises at the same simultaneously going on. So it's really great that they're doing that. And I think that in Hillary's case, we had probably a bigger team than even I had in 2008 because it was just more accepted, more politically acceptable. It wasn't viewed as presumptuous or measuring the drapes or whatever metaphor you want to use. And I think one of the things that we were able to do and plot was to drive and take her promises on the campaign trail and think about how we would, you know, really be able to execute against those in a context in which we certainly weren't certain what the composition of the Congress was going to be. As it turned out, it was Republican-led in both houses. But and I think we were able to map that out in a way that I think was and the documentation of that was useful to the Biden team. You know, you work directly with them, David, so you can correct me if I'm saying something that's not true. But I think our ability to work stream the that policy process was very well done before the election. Unfortunately, we didn't get to utilize it, but I think it was, in the end of the day, it was helpful to the Biden people as they were thinking about the their transition.
No, I agree. I mean, unfortunately, one of the things about transitions is that the work product for the losing candidate is not public. The partnership, fortunately, has been the depository for a lot of the documents. I think that you and Ed Meyer and Ann O'Leary did a fantastic job. And should Hillary Clinton have won, she would have been ready. And it would have been a very professional transition. And I think you made a lot of innovations in that transition as well. Let me ask you about another transition, which was a transition out. You were chief of staff during the Bush v. Gore recount, a bitterly disputed election. And obviously, Bush won the election based on the Supreme Court ruling and the votes in Florida. How was that transition and how difficult was that when obviously you were supporting Gore? Gore was in the White House, and nevertheless, you had to hand over power to the Bush team. How did that go, and what did you do as chief of staff to make that a smooth transition?
First of all, I think we tried to be professional in terms of whoever was coming into office to prepare the groundwork for that, you know, with respect to both the work the agencies do to give people a real sense of what the challenges are, what the opportunities are, what the budget looks like, what the IGs have been saying about what the problems that need correction are. We took that responsibility quite seriously and professionally. My deputy at the time, Maria Echaveste, ran that process throughout the government. We were, I think, well prepared on in November to do that. As it turned out, the winner wasn't decided until December, when the Supreme Court, in the famous 5-4 Bush v. Gore decision, essentially ended the counting in Florida, and Vice President Gore conceded. So I think that was the first thing we did. It was professionally and well prepared. It was abbreviated because of that. Andy Carr, Josh Bolton, both of whom later became Bush chiefs of staff, were working on the transition during that period of time. But because this was really, you know, relatively close to Christmas and the holidays and whatever, Governor Bush didn't come to see President Clinton, if I remember right, till the first week of January. And while the president hosted Governor Bush for a one-on-one session in the residence, My deputies and my senior team hosted Andy and Josh in my office for a very long lunch because our lunch was timed to their lunch, and they took a long time talking through what President Clinton viewed as the big challenges President Bush would encounter on January 20th. And we tried to, as rapidly as possible, hand things off. One of the things that we didn't do in 2000 that the Bush team prepared and did in 2008 was a tabletop exercise with the NSC. I raise that, David, because I think both in my meetings with Andy and Josh, I know with the president's meeting with President Bush, and with the national security briefings that Sandy Berger had with Condoleezza Rice, we had been seized by the threat of what was going on with Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. I think we sort of imparted that information, but I think one of the effects of that truncated period of time was we were unable, I think, to put the focus of their security team really on the threat of bin Laden. That was kind of well documented in the 9/11 Commission report, and some changes, including changes to the transition laws, were made as a result to try to better prepare, particularly in that national security arena, try to better prepare for the handoff or that they were likely to confront, And I think that, again, President Bush took that very seriously. So I saw the effect of that, both the ability to accelerate security clearances in front of the election, to be able to work and connect our national security team to their national security team, up through and doing a tabletop exercise on that was about terrorism in the early days of 2009 with the incoming team. And I think that was very, very helpful to the Obama team coming into office.
Yes, and the tabletop exercise is now mandated by law, and appropriately and perhaps regrettably, the Obama team, Lisa Monaco, prepared a tabletop exercise for the incoming Trump team, which was on pandemic planning. So obviously it's relevant. And then I would also remind you that you and President Clinton did something, I think, admirable during.
Yeah, I think as President Obama said last week, I think they must have used the documents as doorstops.
The other thing that President Clinton and you did, which I think is admirable, during the recount was that you authorized then Governor Bush to get the most extensive full intelligence briefings available as if he were going to be president-elect. You felt, and then President Clinton felt, that that was sufficiently important that he should get the benefit of that, which I think is very admirable.
Right. I think we made that decision maybe a couple of weeks into that period of the recount. But by late November, we definitely said it was our responsibility as the outgoing administration to ensure that the incoming administration, and obviously we at that point we still were hopeful that Vice President Gore could prevail in the recount, but whatever the outcome, we had to be do as good a job as we could to prepare both sides, really, obviously, but Vice President Gore was already receiving those briefings, but we enabled the CIA to kind of fully engage with the then governor, not quite yet president-elect, Governor Bush, and his team, including Steve Hadley, Condoleezza Rice, I think, maybe some others, to be able to fully get access to the highest level secrets so that they could begin to prepare what they were thinking about and how they were going to approach the big security challenges that the country was facing.
So let's fast forward to the next transition you were involved in, which was the Bush to Obama transition. So you led the transition effort, you chaired it. You weren't really that close to Obama. And in fact, you were supporting Hillary Clinton in the primary. So why in the heck did he pick you to run a transition when you weren't even that close to him?
Yeah, well, I was friendly with Obama, I have to say. I didn't know him until he started running for the Senate. I think I casually shook hands with him at the convention when he gave that famous red state, blue state speech, because he did the keynote and he was followed by President Clinton, who I was, you know, still working with when he gave his speech that evening. But I got to know him in the Senate race a little bit. And then I worked with him when he was senator. I was running the Center for American Progress. He came and spoke there. I talked him into doing, along with some help from some other of his friends in Illinois, into doing a important speech for him at the commencement address at the college I went to, Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, which he did in the spring of 2005. So we had worked together and we were friendly. And I even talked to him about running for president as he was thinking about it in 2007. But I was for Hillary. I told him that right at the outset of the campaign. He had people around him who I had worked with on Capitol Hill and worked with in the White House. I think they suggested my name to him. And I was somewhat surprised when he asked me. But I think he thought my experience as White House Chief of Staff was quite relevant. And so he asked me to do it, and I said that I would, and also that I didn't want a job in the administration. So it made it all kind of smooth. And then he wanted to make sure that people close to him were part of the transition council structure, and that was fine with me. And I think we ended up with quite a good and open relationship, and I was integrated into his team, as it were.
So it's interesting because it reminds me of Jim Baker, who was on Transition Lab, and he said that, you know, he became chief of staff to President Reagan, even though he ran two campaigns against Reagan. And so it's interesting that Obama picked you for this important position.
Well, if I can just go off to the side, the best presidents like strong people around them. They don't like yes people around them, and they don't try to terrorize and intimidate their staff. They accept that they're going to have an honest and open relationship with the people who are working for them. And that was certainly true of the two presidents I worked for. And, you know, I think to his credit, Obama really liked and respected people who would challenge him, fight with him. In the end of the day, he got elected. He was the president. He called the shots. But he was definitely, he wasn't paranoid about having, you know, people who were tough with him and certainly not sycophants around him.
So in 2008, we had a financial crisis and two wars. And Bush and Obama and you and Josh Bolton actually worked pretty well together. Rahm Emanuel was part of that. And there was just enormous collaboration on TARP, on the auto bailout, on the financial crisis, Hank Paulson, Tim Geithner, and others. So today we're facing essentially multiple crises. We have a financial crisis that made, you know, it's very, very difficult, huge unemployment. We have a health crisis. What lessons learned are there from 2008 to 2009 that might be applicable should Vice President Biden win?
Yeah, and just to pick up on Biden's message, we also have a racial justice crisis and a climate crisis, and we need to address all of them. They're interconnected. They intersect with each other, and we have to connect with all of them. I think just to praise the Bush team for one more minute, I think the president recognized fairly early on that the two wars, that's what he was thinking about. That's what had dominated his presidency in the last few years. And that's what he was thinking about. He wanted a smooth transition no matter who was elected. He you know, gave that clear message to Josh Bolton and Joel Kaplan, who was Josh's deputy. And they, I think, couldn't have given us better support, because they were thinking, we've got this national security crisis that we're dealing with. Then the financial crisis occurs. So that broadened out. And the preparation they had done was really very focused on in the national security space. We obviously broadened it out to the economy and to the financial space. But then again, I think there was a lot of support coming from, and almost, I kind of think some of the people involved wish they could get out early and just kind of hand particularly the financial mess over to us. But we only have one president at a time, so they were their calls. But we tried to work smoothly with his team. I think they tried to preserve optionality for us. We did the same, by the way, in 2000 for the incoming Bush team, so that the range of decisions that might be made by Obama were preserved. And you could have cut that off and changed that dynamic had they so chosen, but they didn't. And so we're coming into a transition where you have a very, use a nice word, kind of erratic decision-making structure in the White House. It's a very challenging circumstance. But I think the Biden team understood that right from the get-go, and I think they're preparing for that. Hopefully, if Biden does win, and I certainly hope that he does, General Service Agency, which importantly turns over a lot of necessary funding and support to the president-elect's transition team, will do that in a professional and nonpartisan way. We'll get going. I think the guy, David, you know well, who's running the government side of the transition, Chris Lydell, had experience with Governor Romney and with Governor Leavitt running Governor Romney's transition. So I'm sure that's being handled as, you know, professionally, but it does take the commitment of the president, the president's chief of staff, and the rest of the White House structure to make it work smoothly. So they'll just have to deal with whatever comes their way. But they have to integrate an approach that from the get-go has a White House that's up, running, functioning, in crisis mode to deal with the pandemic, but they've got to also be working these other issues and problems simultaneously. So whether that's the economic recovery, dealing with the kinds of investments that the vice president has promised the American people, dealing day one with the racial justice issues, with the climate issues that he's talked about in the campaign and was the subject of back and forth in the debates. He's got to integrate that, have a plan to go right out of the gates, have a team that can manage crisis for virtually, you know, as soon as he takes his hand off the Bible, you know, they're going to be have to be operational.
So the Obama transition in is widely seen as the best transition in the history of the United States, which you led. So congratulations for that. But we're always looking to learn what you can do better. So what, looking back, what are the things that you could have done better in 2008 that should Biden win that you would advise them to do better than you did, even though yours was the best in history to that point?
Well, I should say that the transition was co-led. We really haven't talked about this. Valerie Jarrett and Pete Rouse, who were both headed into the White House, were co-chairs of the transition. Particularly in the period before the election, they were working on the election. I was working on the transition. But, you know, subsequent to that, they were full partners in this. I think, you know, we were credited with doing a pretty good job of getting a senior level personnel into the transition. I would really even step that up further. I think if you look particularly at the presidential nominee, the PASs, the presidential appointed Senate confirmed nominees, I think we had something like 100 done in the first 3 months. I think you could be racked up, make quick decisions, make good decisions, accelerate that process, pressure the Senate to act, and really be, you know, fully engaged in getting your people inside the government. That's something I think that was particularly got slow under President Clinton. We got the cabinet done right away, and then the rest took forever. But we improved upon that with Obama, but I think you can jack that up. The other thing that we laid the groundwork for, but it didn't happen really, was, and you see what the effect of what Trump and McConnell have been able to do, we sort of racked up the accelerating the process on judicial nominations, but they had so many things they were trying to do on the legislative side that they didn't prioritize filling those judicial seats. And you see now how important that is.
Yeah. So here's the data. So you had the best transition ever, Obama did. He had 191 nominations in the Senate. 69 were confirmed in the first 100 days. The Senate was pretty tough. Even there was 59 Democrats, I think. They were pretty slow in moving Obama's nominees, and hopefully the Senate would move fast this cycle. And then also around 400 Schedule Cs and 63 non-career SES, which are basically the senior non-confirmed people. So that's the fastest start ever. But as you said, we should be doing better.
Yeah, one of the things that Biden's has done, and I would say this is an innovation and smart one, is that they have, this is all sort of hush-hush, but they've got different teams working on the PASs and the non-PAS appointments. And I think they've done that because they recognize how much help, really the top tier, the cabinet secretaries who probably will be day one or day two, they need help. And so they've got a structure that can really even accelerate those non-PAS positions into office. And, you know, I think that's smart and a good thing, even as they also try to push forward and do even better job than we did on the PAS front.
So let me move to the next election. So I've always wanted to ask you this, because we had lunch a couple months after the 2016 election. I remember you saying that you had just kind of got to end up the covers and your jammies were off and you were just kind of dusting off. But I remember the night that you walked out in the Javits Center on national TV and kind of announced that we'll have more news tomorrow, but things were looking bad at that point. I think it was 2 or 3 in the morning. So what were you thinking as you walked out on that stage? What was going through your mind?
You know, look, I had to, it was an emotional evening, obviously, for everybody. I had to, keep my shit together, if you can say that on a podcast. And I had a staff that was, sensing that this was not going to turn around. And I had the thousands of supporters that were still in the Javits Center at that point. So I wanted to try to buck people up as best as I could. I wanted to tell them that the cause they were involved with was an important one. And our candidate was a wonderful human being who needed we needed to keep supporting her. So I did the best I could, but it was one of the hardest things I've probably ever had to do. And because I was aware, even though we were still counting, we were looking for votes, that we were behind in all three of those states. And it was, by the time I got out there, it was going to be sort of miraculous to win them all back. We still thought we had a shot at maybe one or two of them, but winning them all back, and particularly Pennsylvania, which I think the spread was about 40,000 votes, was going to be a tremendous chore. But, I needed to do it, and I went out and did it. And then Secretary Clinton gave a really magnificent and gracious speech the next morning to the team. But look, those weeks were brutal, kind of shutting the office down, trying to deal with people who felt crushed, tried to deal with a lot of people around the country who really felt crushed. And at some points, you just got to do hard things. So that's what I did.
All right. So I have two final questions for you. First question is, should Vice President Biden win, the rush of job seekers that are going to be inundating the transition team will be overwhelming. So you were the recipient of that rush in 2008. What's your advice to both the transition team for handling that? And what's your advice to the people that want jobs on the best way to get a job and the best way to not get a job?
Yeah, I think the best way to get a job, you're kind of a little late to, which is help them get elected. And, that's pretty crucial that you're perceived as putting your oar in the water and really helping Vice President Biden and Senator Harris get elected. But they want to reach beyond just the people in that camp. I'm sure they're going to try to think about, keep the promise of bringing the country together. They'll probably reach out and bring some Republicans into the government. And, there's plenty to pick from who didn't support Trump, but aren't, front and center in the Biden campaign. But there are others, professionals, people in state and local government, people in business, who weren't that into politics, but who have something to contribute, something to give back to the country that they'll be looking at, reaching out to. And those people also will probably reach in and say, I want to serve. And I want to try to help the country heal and provide the benefit of my professional experience and my energy. And they'll want to get, more young people engaged in the government as well. And that's a group of people that probably a lot of whom have been turned off by the last 4 years, but I think they'll turn right around and want to do things. But my advice is just make it. There will be a process. I don't think that the process was probably kind of willy-nilly in 1992. By 2008, 2016, we had systems to intake people who wanted to serve, to take on board their resumes, to kind of sort through those, get them to the right people so that they can be looked at. a lot of this is obviously the way, you know, kind of professional headhunting works, which is you're looking for talent and in a variety of different places. But there's also people who kind of come into the process by putting their hand up, and I would encourage people to do that. And then the thing that usually doesn't work that well, you can demonstrate that you have some support, but you don't want to be a pest. So you got to find the right balance between having, you know, if you've got congressional support, having a few key members of Congress write on your behalf or make a phone call or two. But if you overdo that, you know, you can annoy people too. So I guess it's like getting a job in any other sphere, but the difference is, you know, you're filling these thousands of top tier jobs, you know, within a very, very abbreviated time. And there's a lot of pressure on the people doing the headhunting, doing the searching, doing the professional job reviews. And then obviously you have to be able to get through the vetting process and be able to demonstrate that there's nothing that in your background that's going to embarrass an incoming administration. But, you know, that's usually pretty easy for most people.
Co, my final question is this. So you have kind of reinvented yourself into maybe a climate activist. I mean, that's kind of what you're doing with your time. Is that correct? And so,
yeah, I kind of don't, I probably reject the reinvention. I kind of been a climate activist for a long time, but yes, that's what I'm, you know, subsequent to 2016, I no longer run the Center for American Progress. Neera Tanden does, and, you know, doing a fantastic job, but I have a base of operations to work on climate change there with a really, really excellent team. And that's led by a woman named Christy Golfus. And that's what I care about. That's what I'm spending most of my time on.
So what are the two or three most important decisions that a President Biden could take that would address the climate crisis as you see it?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, there's just so much to do. Getting it down to two or three is going to be difficult. I think there's a couple of things, though, that he has to do. It's going to be much easier to do if there's a Democratic Senate. But if there is a Democratic Senate, he has put out a very ambitious program of investment to change the energy system to get on track to a net zero emissions trajectory by 2050, to have 100% clean power sector by 2035. If he's got Democratic control of the Senate, I'm sure he will have Democratic control of the House. Then he has to make good on that investment strategy. If McConnell still is the leader, right now, it looks, a year ago, it didn't look plausible that the Democrats would pick up the Senate. Right now, it seems maybe a little bit more likely than not. I think it'll still be tight, but a little bit more likely than not, Democrats will be in control. Chuck Schumer will be the leader. Then you got to go for it. You got to go for it and really prioritize those investments that he put forward and has campaigned on. And that is job number one. Get credible globally by doing the job domestically here. And that'll take a lot of skill. That'll take a lot of focus and support and a prioritization to make this a top tier issue in budget stimulus, in budget reconciliation, et cetera. That's a 2021 project. I think to get the all of government approach that's needed, he has to fix on how he wants to structure, particularly his White House, to set ambitious goals and manage and have accountable the entire cabinet and the agencies of government for success. I would put that high on the list. And then he has to have international strategy. And as I've written with my friend Todd Stern, I think he has to put climate change at the center of his foreign policy. That doesn't mean just returning to the Paris Agreement, which I think he will do, but he's got to increase the ambition everywhere. And there's some good news there. The EU has adopted, as Biden has suggested, a 100% clean net zero economy by 2050. Japan just signed on to that. 68 other countries have signed on to it. China has proposed getting to net zero by 2060, which surprised everybody. But man, that's an enormous effort. And just to close out, the IPCC, the group of climate scientists that guide the global analysis of what's happening in the world, describe the need to get to hold global average temperatures to 1.5 degrees C, the need to get to net zero by mid-century. But to do that, they describe that as an economic transformation on the size and scale that's never occurred in human history. So that's what Biden has to be thinking about when he puts his hand on the Bible and gets sworn into office. An economic transformation on the size and scale that's never occurred before in human history. And I think he's up for that, but that's a big deal, man.
Well, maybe he can draft John Podesta to help him. John Podesta.
I've already noted that I'm too old for that. So,
thank you for your time. Thank you for your wisdom. And most importantly, thank you for all you've done in service to our country.
Thanks, Dave.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast apps.